College students are struggling to find Christ in a culture that rejects God. They need the Christmas message of hope and truth now more than ever. Thanks to a generous matching gift, every dollar you give to the Thomistic Institute before December 31st will be doubled, so your gift will touch twice as many souls. You can give the greatest of all gifts by sending the light of Christ to students aching for truth. Please use the link below or go to thomisticinstitute.org/donate to give today.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
It may not be surprising that the first American pope wasted almost no time in office before sharing his reflection on sports. Less than 6 weeks into his pontificate, in his homily on the Solemnity of the Holy Trinity, which happened to coincide with the Jubilee of Sports, Leo XIV tells us that, and do we have the handout? Did people get the handout? Okay, great. So that'll be coming around. That's right. We'll get it in just a second here, but I'll read this one, and as we get to the handout, you can look at that as well. Quote, "This combination of Trinity and sport is somewhat unusual. Yet the juxtaposition is not inappropriate. Every good and worthwhile human activity is in some way a reflection of God's infinite beauty, and sport is certainly one of these. For God is not immobile and closed in on himself, but God is activity, communion, a dynamic relationship between Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, which opens up to humanity and to the world." As he goes on to say, some of the church fathers spoke of God as one who plays, as is fitting for a God who is a relation of persons. Sports can be sanctified then by, quote, "challenging us to relate to others and with others, not only outwardly, but also and above all interiorly. Otherwise, sport becomes nothing more than an empty competition of inflated egos." When played rightly, sports fosters friendship, and habits of giving ourselves to others in pursuit of greatness. Think of the saying, give me the ball, give me the ball. The sense that we need to give to one another. The Holy Father goes on to list three reasons why problematic aspects of our culture make sports today a precious means for training in human and Christian virtues. First, sports are an antidote to our radical individualism. They provide a training in putting others first, in seeing that cooperation and reconciliation are necessary for victory. Second, they get us off our devices, helping us preserve a healthy contact with nature and with real life, where genuine love is experienced. Third, it forces us in learning the art of losing to confront one of the deepest truths of our human condition, our fragility, our limitations, and our imperfections. You don't have to be a Chicago White Sox fan to appreciate how hard it is and how much you learn about losing. Okay, I'm sorry. Those of you are white, I just had to say that. It's a joke on the Pope, too, so, you know, it's in good fun. Losing is more central to sports than is victory. Even the greatest slugger will strike out more often than he hits a home run. And even the greatest team will fail to win the championship more often than it raises the trophy in triumph. On the field, we are training for life off the field. In the weight room, we are pushing ourselves to go out and be more than ourselves. In the stands, we are hoping for a victory that will be everlasting. Yet should our training prove inadequate, our body be crushed under the weight of our willpower, our cheering be in vain, this experience of loss can teach us to nourish our soul by throwing ourselves at the feet of the God whose loss on Good Friday was the instrument of our salvation. When we say, let the best one win, while we are hoping that we prove to be best, we are also accepting the possibility of loss and preparing ourselves to be gracious should the game end with our defeat. Whether we win or lose, we can see that the best is yet to come, so let us give to God the glory. While sports can be a great teacher of virtue and a training field for our restless heart, the Holy Father reminds us that it can also devolve into an empty competition of inflated egos. No matter how great we become at a sport, and no matter how victorious our team, this does not of itself make us great as humans or as a community. It would take quite a stretch of the imagination and biased love of our own to fail to see that our all-stars and our dynasties often do not stand out for their excellence off the field. It is important, then, that we don't get carried away in our praise of sports. If anything, we suffer as a culture from a disordered love for sports. And this leads us to turn a blind eye to the moral failings of our favorite running back, to ignore the way in which our team uses its players as cannon fodder, to neglect the education of boys and girls who will never make it pro and struggle to find a job due to the lack of career preparation, and to overlook the disproportionate funding for sports at the expense of the performing and liberal arts. What I propose to do with you tonight is to take a more sober look at sports than we usually want to do. Using insights from St. Thomas Aquinas on virtue as the measure of moral excellence and human happiness, and highlighting how central friendship is in sports and in right living, we'll gain a better understanding of what it means to be excellent as athletes and as human beings. As a result, we will be better prepared for the upcoming game, because we will love our play and our team rightly, given our commitment to order these to the heavenly goal of this race called life. Since virtue is the measure of morality, we need to analyze whether we can be called virtuous by competing at sports. Let's start with three ways in which one is not properly speaking virtuous in sports. Three ways in which you're not virtuous simply because you're good at sports. First, just by being physically strong, graceful, or limber, even as a result of training. That doesn't make you a virtuous person. Second, by engaging in sub-rational actions, even when there's a kind of perfection there. And third, by doing an immoral activity, even when we're excellent at doing it. So first, we can only by analogy call physical strength virtue. If you look at that quote number three there, it's a long quote. I'm not going to read it all, but I think it should be in bold, this section I'm about to read here. For instance, if a man can carry 100 weight and not more, his virtue, and in the brackets there we have a note, the term we would really want to use in English here is strength. His strength is put at 100 weight and not at 60. So if I said I have 350 horse virtue under the hood of my car, right? You said it's not like a virtuous car. I mean, it's got power more than the other car does, but it's not virtuous. And so bodily perfections aren't in themselves virtues except by analogy. So when we talk about muscle memory, for example, or instilled habit in the body to perform a physical action, Aquinas can in some sense endorse this. Habits can be secondarily in the body, namely insofar as the body is disposed and enabled with promptitude to help in the operations of the soul. But he is careful to point out that even such habits as throwing a fastball or kicking a field goal are primarily in the soul that directs the body. And that's why our favorite pitcher can suddenly become a basket case. He's got everything he needs, but suddenly he can't hit the strike zone. Something happens, the body is ready, and it's the soul there that can't command it. Further, to the extent that we could call such an action virtuous, this too is not virtue properly speaking. The perfection of these bodily powers, natural powers as the term Aquinas uses, since they are determined to a specific action, can be called virtues in only an analogous sense, in that they allow us to be better capable of action. Only the soul can be perfected in sense of allowing us to act rightly. And in this sense, Aquinas speaks of virtue as an operative habit, a habit that directs us to an action. While the various bodily perfections that allow one to hit a home run, throw a changeup, or kick a 60-yard field goal can be called virtues by analogy. They are not moral or intellectual virtues, and so they don't perfect us as human beings. Aquinas tells us, virtue which is referred to being is not proper to man, but only that virtue which is referred to works of reason. Again, in action theory, we speak of the physical goodness of an action. For example, punching hard, accurately, and without hurting oneself, as distinct from the moral goodness, for example, defending the innocent using these forms of violence. Unless reason guides our action, they are not virtuous. And this, for example, is why we do not call the trained dog who can follow our commands virtuous. For it is the human who issues the command that the dog is habituated to obey who is virtuous. And by contrast, that's why we blame the person who trains the dog or who owns the dog if the dog does something harmful. So second, we can even speak of the perfection of a power that is incompatible with virtue. And so we could question whether certain physical actions demanded by a sport are compatible with virtue. Aquinas analyzes Isaiah 5. Here's the quote from the Bible. "Woe to you that are mighty to drink wine and stout men at drunkenness." This is relevant. Aquinas says, "The evil of drunkenness and excessive drink consists in a falling away from the order of reason. Now it happens that, together with this falling away from reason, some lower power is perfect in reference to that which belongs to its kind, even in direct opposition to reason. But the perfection of that power, since it is compatible with a falling away from reason, cannot be called a human virtue. Can one train for drinking games? Sure. And by doing so, one could get mighty at drinking and stout. But perfecting our stomach and mind's ability to handle alcohol is not a virtue. Now, of course, we could imagine someone using this for good, or at least I could. A spy who engages in a drinking game with the enemy so as to get information out of him. But this doesn't make it a virtue, but only a power that could be used for a virtuous end. More broadly, let's think of training regimens that are so taxing as to make our minds weak and incapable of clear thinking. Is it possible that the physical greatness we see on the field is due to a practice schedule that makes the players incapable of study, or even of a basic cultivation of the powers of moral reasoning? If so, such a team is undermining the human virtue to which these powers ought to be directed. Third, we can see how the drinking game not only fails at being virtuous because it doesn't perfect our character, but it also involves us in a vice, drunkenness. The third and final way in which a sport could involve excellence but not virtue would be if it involves inherently immoral activity. Aquinas' example is being good at thieving. We can analogously speak of the virtue of a good thief, but he's morally vicious. The question for us then is whether or not there's sports that are inherently immoral. Gladiatorial games come to mind. And we could ask whether MMA or other extremely violent sports fall into this category. Aquinas discusses this in the context of war. This is quote 4 on your handout. "Manly exercises and warlike feats of arms outside of war are not all forbidden. But those are forbidden which are inordinate and perilous and end in slaying or plundering. In olden times, warlike exercises presented no such danger, and hence they were called exercises of arms or bloodless wars." Evidently, the church denied Christian burial in the Middle Ages to men who died in tournaments, as we have depicted here. And Aquinas is here arguing that warlike exercises are not inherently vicious, but only become so if they are inordinate and perilous. It was not uncommon for men to be killed in tournaments, as we see in the image. And we could say that such sports fell somewhere between war or gladiatorial combat and contemporary violent sports. So I think I didn't actually see the blood in this because I was looking on my laptop. When you see this, I mean, you know, where you see this man's been killed, is that, I mean, the tournament then does allow for the killing of the opponent. And so it's very different when the church is banning, and the church was very ineffective at this. I mean, it was just so popular that, you know, this is not what we mean when we talk about, say, football, right? This is a very different reality. We might think today of something like dueling. Like, that was very hard to get rid of in modern cultures of, you know, dueling, of people, "You've insulted my honor, and so now we're going to kill each other." Boxing also comes to mind, for it is a serious question as to whether or not a sport that involves punching one another in the head is inherently vicious due to the harmful effects this will have on rational development. If we're concerned about the concussion dangers of sports like football, at least here the hit to the head is forbidden, even if it's inevitable that it will happen. So again, I'm not saying that I think boxing is immoral. I'm saying it's a real question, that we really do need to think about this. There were really interesting arguments. I believe boxing was the third most popular sport in the early 20th century. Today, it's not near as popular. There were very serious arguments among, especially among Christians, about whether or not this was morally acceptable. So in all three of these ways, first, cultivating a physical power without looking at virtue. Second, cultivating a physical power contrary to virtue. And then third, vicious activity. It's easy to see in each of these cases why a sport doesn't make us virtuous. Even if there are reasonable disagreements to be had regarding whether sports like boxing are compatible with virtue, in none of these cases do we think that playing the sport makes us morally virtuous. Let us move on to consider ways in which it might seem that excellence in sports would lead to moral virtue. And there's three considerations here, this time moving ever closer to human virtue in this order. So first, one can practice the intellectual virtues of art and prudence in sports to some extent, yet not necessarily be morally virtuous. Second, to the extent that there is a common good of the community of athletes, owners, fans, moral virtue does come into play. And then third, we can see the foundations of moral virtue in sports in the friendly feelings it can generate and which form the basis of friendship. Right. We could define sport. So what is sport? And I think I got a pretty good definition here that's going to rule out certain things. Sport is this. It's an art by which bodily and mentally powers are directed to the production of works that will lead to victory in accordance with agreed upon rules. Okay, so we can talk about that later. I'm going to rule out then games, board games, and including chess would not be sports, and war wouldn't be a sport either, based on that definition. But figure skating would be. And we'll talk about breakdancing, if you're an Olympics fan. Well, we may be inclined to think that sports are not arts. That probably doesn't seem right to you, right? Art? There's an art department, music and sports, not the same. Because they don't obviously produce something physical, right? In the language of the virtues, arts can be classified, or sports can be classified as arts, insofar as the athlete or coach reasons toward the production of something, in this case actions, and these are nothing other than works of art. It may be easier to see this in performative sports, for in such sports, the goal is to produce a routine that leads to receiving a high score from a judge. So again, victory is the goal. So competitive cheerleading, right? Cheerleading is not a sport, but if we're competing upon agreed upon rules, it's now a sport. Admittedly, again, there are debates to be had. Breakdancing in the Summer Olympics, a lot of people are like, really? Like breakdancing? And I think you'd say, well, if figure skating is, why would it not be? What would be the basis of that? And I would argue that breakdancing is a sport in that because there is some agreed upon rules for victory. But bear with me. At the end of the talk, you could ask. The figure skater or gymnast makes a variety of bodily configurations that are judged on criteria like gracefulness and execution. And then we agree that whoever has the higher score, even though judges are going to differ slightly between one another about how relatively important these are, that you get the medal and I don't. To have the virtue of art here is to reason well regarding what should be made, as distinct from who and how one should be. Art, as Aquinas defines it, is nothing else but the right reason about works to be made. And yet the good of these things depends not on our appetites being affected in the right way, but on the goodness of the work done. For a craftsman is commendable, not for the will with which he does a work, but for the quality of the work. So in other words, if we want to know if you're a good craftsman, we look at the work, we don't look at you. You probably look pretty bad afterwards. Like you got wood shavings all over you, right? You can be a morally bad person and be great at making chairs, right? That might get harder when it comes to other kinds of arts, like maybe poetry would be one that might be harder to be good at it and be bad morally. In other sports, one makes a basket, a goal, or a home run, or makes a play that is intended to lead to one of these in order to achieve victory. Aquinas' distinction between the virtue of art and moral action helps us to explain a point that is surely evident to fans. The graceful figure skater and lights-out point guard are not necessarily morally good people. I am from Portland, Oregon, where our greatest skater, anybody know her name?
Tanya Harding,
was involved in a hit on her opponent. Nancy Kerrigan. And our basketball team at one point earned the nickname the Jailblazers. This was when I was in college, after the great Clyde Drexler moved on, who was a classy person. While we can speak of true virtue here, we do not call the players virtuous for being even masters of their craft. Another intellectual virtue that is required in sports, though, brings us closer to moral action, and that is prudence. Prudence is like art, and yet it differs in that its perfection is of us. We are made perfect, whereas in art, the thing is made perfect. Okay, this is quote number 5. It's kind of a long one, but I think it's worth reading because this is an important point about art as distinct from prudence. Prudence is the right reason of things to be done, not things to be made. That's the distinction. Now, making and doing differ in that making is an action passed into an outward matter. For example, to build, to saw, and so forth. Whereas doing is an action abiding in the agent, to see, to will, and the like. It is requisite for prudence, which is right reason about things to be done, that man be well disposed with regard to the ends, and this depends on the rectitude of his appetite. Wherefore, for prudence, there is need of a moral virtue which rectifies the appetite. On the other hand, the good things made by art is not the good of man's appetite, but the good of those things themselves. Wherefore, art does not presuppose rectitude of the appetite. So let's just take one example, gratitude. I can't be grateful for what you did without some sort of affection within me, a passion in me. If I simply say thank you and I don't feel the right thing when I say it, I don't have the virtue. It may be good for kids to do that, to train them so that in the future they actually will be grateful to grandma for the gift, but they're not grateful in the full sense unless they actually have the right passion. And art isn't like that. I mean, the art is simply the fact that I produce the object. So now you could push back on this claim that a great athlete can have bad moral character by pointing to examples of athletes whose game went downhill when they fell into vicious living, right? That seems to be possible that would happen. There's something to this, and I think prudence helps us to see it. If you cannot bring your appetites under control, you cannot show up for practice every day. You cannot keep yourself from being rattled by the heckler or by the intensity of that play with 3 seconds left on the clock. Especially when we focus on team sports, we see that being prudent in sports requires something central to moral life. Coordinated action in relation to members of a community. Isn't that what moral life is about? In order to do this, an athlete must form her appetites so that she seeks the good of the team as a whole, and this requires bringing in the other cardinal virtues. Justice, feeding the ball to the one to whom it is due, or obeying the coach. Courage, standing one's ground when blocking for a player. And temperance, being humble so that others on the team can shine. While in some sense we can call the running back great who has all the skills necessary for success, if he cannot adjust his excellence to the team's play calling or to the strategy of the coach and quarterback, he's not properly speaking a great running back. That being said, we should be cautious about claiming that the good running back has the virtue of prudence. For you can have prudence. In order to have prudence, you need to have the moral virtues. That's not true of other intellectual virtues. Once again, we see sports as fostering virtue on the field, but not necessarily making its players morally virtuous when they take off their jersey. While excellence in sports requires art, this virtue of art, it's only by analogy that we can call the great competitor prudent. We might say something like crafty, strategic. A second avenue for exploring moral virtue in sport enters in when we consider the social aspect of a sport. As Pope Leo XIV observed, one of the problems in modern life is the tendency towards, on the one hand, individualism, on the other hand, centralization. The more we push for individual liberty, understood as the freedom to do whatever I want, as long as I don't hurt another, the more we rely on the Leviathan of the modern state to protect this individual liberty. The effect, paradoxically, is to undermine the very societies, the family, the neighborhood, local government, charities, churches, sports leagues, that do the most good in supporting our personal formation. The state can't raise you, right? We need societies that are very local to raise you. To the extent to which sports provides a buffer against this tendency of the individual and the collective, They provide an important outlet for character formation. To play a sport, even an individual one such as tennis or golf, is to become a member of a society. As Russell Hittinger points out in a seminal article on Catholic social teaching, this is quote number 6 on the handout there, wherever there are plural rational agents aiming at common ends, through united action, and where the unity is one of the intrinsic goods aimed at, we have a society, something distinct in dignity. The group is said to have an extrinsic common good, victory for the army or for the team, and an intrinsic common good, the common order of its action. While professional sports have a tendency to obscure the fact that the goal of sports is not the aggrandizement of the player, even there we see how important it is that the players and coaches subordinate their private good to the good of the team. Further, while the players all share in common the goal of victory, they must come to see that forming a unit is intrinsic to their play. When they achieve synchrony, when the quarterback and receivers lock in, when they're firing on all cylinders, when they gel, they achieve a common good that is both good for its own sake and also a cause of the extrinsic good of victory. When they feed off the concerted cheering and even jeering of the home crowd, all the better. We, the fans, know this. Part of our love of the game is seeing our team achieve this united action. And this is why, even when they lose, we still believe that we can get them the next time. This is also why we know that the team that achieves victory is not always the best, either because of a bad call, unfavorable conditions, or worse still, because the victorious team undermined its intrinsic good by cheating, and they got away with it. So here we see the moral formation of player, coach, and fan. When we say, let the best one win, we're putting ourselves on the side of moral virtue. We're indicating we want the game's rules and regulations, the team and the player strategy, and the officiating crew's calls to be just. We want whoever has achieved the highest level of united action to be rewarded with the extrinsic good of victory, even if that player or team is not our own. And we're forced to watch in stunned silence an excellence that outstrips our own. So I got to go to a wild card game when the Pirates played the Giants. And you're probably a little young for this, but Madison Bumgarner, possibly the greatest postseason performance in World Series history. And this was the first game. So going to the sixth inning, you know, it was looking pretty good. And all of a sudden, I don't remember who it was, one of the Giants players hit a grand slam. It was amazing how quiet it got. I mean, not a sound. It's just seeing everyone in stunned silence. So on the one hand, it's everyone saying it's over. I mean, you just tell, it's over. We're not going to be able to come back to this. But on the other hand, I think there's also this awe there, right? Wow, they're better. I mean, just we saw this, they're better. There's something about those moments that we see excellence, and that's what we love. We can set aside that aspect. It's funny, it was a blackout because the Pirates wear black. And I thought, I'm from San Francisco. We wear black too. This isn't a home field advantage. You know, we should have done a yellow out, I guess, or whatever that would be. Okay, so back to this. For players, the fact that they are members of a society and are called upon to pursue a common good means they cannot be good players without subordinating their appetites and their wills to the reasoning of the coaches placed over them in positions of authority. There's a higher kind of prudence coupled with the other cardinal virtues here than in our previous consideration of the individual on his or her own. For whenever we obey and carry out virtuously the legitimate command of an authority, we achieve a common good that is the aim of moral life. Aquinas calls this general justice. And to possess this virtue is even greater than to possess all of the particular virtues, because it directs them to the common good. While this does not necessarily mean that the virtuous competitor's team will win, it does make them good and even great players. Those athletes who are vicious, insofar as they act contrary to this general virtue, will undermine the team in the long run. If your team begins to sign players of dubious moral character, this may be because they hope to rehabilitate him or her. But more often, it is either a sign of desperation or a sign of subordinating the team's intrinsic good to money or fame. And this does not end well. Before we go too far with this attempt to make a moral virtue of playing for the common good of the team, We need to point out that even here, athletes are not, properly speaking, virtuous unless they direct their sport to the broader goals of human life. Even if we define the good player as the one who directs this prowess to the united action of the team, this doesn't make the good player a good human being. To be good on the field is not necessarily to be good off it. In political theory, we emphasize the distinction between the good citizen and the good person. Unless your team has its home city, the heavenly Jerusalem, do you think there will be sports in heaven? That's a good question. You're not aligning yourselves against the forces of evil when you go into the huddle. Unless you're a citizen of the city of God, you're not fighting against demonic powers when you step up to the plate. And you may think I'm overstating this, but it's all too common for fans to think, talk, and act as if the other team really is morally inferior, that their fans are bad people, and that we morally righteous ones have done our duty when we see them flee before us. When my alma mater's basketball team reached the final 64 in March Madness during my junior year, the slogan, "God is a Gael," became ubiquitous on campus. All right, no one from California can answer this question. Anyone know what college has the Gael as its mascot? Okay, St. Mary's College of California. So they made it to the 16 one year. It was a big, it was Sports Illustrated. A Gael, I've seen an old, it was the Galloping Gael. So it's an Irish, I guess like it's an Irishman. It's kind of the idea here. God is one of us, in other words. I think this was done in good fun. But I also think it speaks to the way we feel when our team starts winning. We're on a mission from God to defeat his foes. Here we see the tension between the saying, "Let the best one win," and the seventh inning stretch line, "Root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame." While there's a healthy patriotism that may even demand of us allegiance to our local team, or in the Olympics, our nation's team, we need to balance our love of the good Hoosier with love of the good team. And from there to love of the good man or the good woman. At our best, this comes out in occasions like an injury on the field, when all take a knee and wish for the good of the opposing team's player. And I think we do see this. It's exceedingly rare that that doesn't happen, right? And if you do, you might want to say, I think we just need to call it off. If my little league doesn't do that, I just say, we're not playing anymore. You know, this is not, that we're not doing the right thing here. So you may have found yourself wondering, wasn't this talk about sports and friendship? Where did friendship come in? All right, I think we're ready for this. It took a while to get to this third consideration of virtue in sports friendship. But if you've read Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, you may have picked up that I'm following that structure. We need to do a lot of thinking about moral life and a lot of character building before we can be good friends. Right? That's why friendship is this goal of life. It's really hard to be a good friend. On the other hand, we need friends in order to have a moral formation. As Aristotle says, friends help us to think and act. So there's kind of a tension there, right? That I learn how to be a good friend from others. But on the other hand, I can't really be a good friend until I become good. Well, I suppose it's possible to become a great competitor without having great friends. This would be an extraordinary feat. The smashing of old records in individual competitions, such as track and field, the building up of dynasties in games like football and basketball, are only possible because coaches devote their lives to mentoring the next Simone Biles. Fathers spend countless hours in the backyard playing catch with their sons. And children run out to the playground with siblings and neighbors for pickup games. If friendship is at the heart of moral life, sports prove once again to be a buffer against the tendency of our culture to undermine character formation through individualism. Aquinas even uses boxing as a favorable example in this regard. But notice from the quote, doesn't necessarily mean he thinks boxing is morally good, at least as I read this. See what you think. He says, "Goodwill sometimes arises suddenly, as happens to us if we look on at a boxing match and we wish one of the boxers to win." Right? Suddenly, we're friendly to somebody who is a stranger just a second ago. I like the way he plays. I like the way that I like her style. Sports help us to root for one another and make it necessary for us to wish good for our teammates and friends when engaged in concerted action and thought. While our friends help us in the serious matter of work and of moral action, I want to turn our attention to another aspect of friendship that helps us think about sports. Friends help us to play rightly, to play so that the best one will win. Of course, this is useful for forming such virtues as justice, and that we learn much about giving others their due when our friends demand that we play fairly. How many times as a kid you have that experience of changing the rules in the middle of the game, right? And you kind of became aware that she's my friend, but on the other hand, I want to win, and that I'm aware there's a tension between what I want and what I ought to do, right? So we learn this about ourselves. But even still, I think playing rightly is important for a higher reason than that. Playing rightly is both about appreciation for things that are good in themselves and also about relaxing the mind for the highest kind of human activity, contemplation, or thinking and resting in the truth. All this time, we've been thinking through the relationship between sports and virtues, but we've been holding back from Aquinas' discussion of the virtue you need to play rightly. It's eutrapelia is the Greek term he's relying on, which literally means a good turn in Greek, and we could translate it as play or playfulness. The virtue of play is a kind of moderation or temperance. Temperance is the regulation of bodily appetites, how much we eat and drink and so forth. Modesty is a kind of temperance, this is quote number 7 in your handout, regarding bodily movements and actions, which require to be done becomingly and honestly, whether we act seriously or in play. Okay, so notice there's either or. Play, then, is that virtue of cheerfulness in words and deeds. While Aquinas seems to be thinking mostly of playfulness in conversation or in comedies, he extends this to games of any sort. His general point is that the serious business of living well requires the relaxation of the mind in things that bring us delight. Whether we are joking with friends or teaming up with them against an opponent, we're doing something simply because it's enjoyable. At the same time, part of the enjoyment is that we will continue to think on it. We'll find ourselves laughing the next morning about the look on our friend's face when she told that joke. We're going to replay in our minds, filled with awe, that tremendous catch. Sports and friendship then work together to point us toward the joyful wonders of life. And this is at the root of the love of what is best, wisdom. Aquinas compares play to contemplation because they're both pleasant in themselves, and because play is not ordered to something else, but is pursued for its own sake. And the same thing can be said of the delights of wisdom. Isn't this why we love watching children play? Is they don't need to go to something else, whereas we get so caught up in, I'm doing this so that something else can happen. And eventually I'll do the thing. The kids just do it. They just do it for itself. As Father James Shaw puts it, in his response to calls to get rid of high school football, his quote number 8, if we take football away from the culture, we will not be doing ourselves a favor. We will deprive ourselves, I suspect, of one of the few natural experiences that lead us to appreciate what it means to speak of higher things, of things that take us out of ourselves, of things that exist out of nothing for their own sakes. Think of that. That came out of nowhere. There's this play, it came out of nowhere. There's this amazing ex nihilo kind of moment in a sport. Another bad tendency of our culture is to instrumentalize every activity, to only see it as good if something useful comes from it. Friendship and sports militate against this by providing us activities in which we can rest. Now, to be clear, we can, of course, abuse the activities of friendship and sports as well, for the rest they provide ought to rejuvenate us for prayer and for work. And sometimes our friendships are draining, and our competitions leave us bitter or exhausted. I mean, how many athletes can't sleep at night because they can't stop playing it over and over again? And there's a concern that it's consuming rather than rejuvenating. I think we see this with our phones too, right? How often do we go to the phone as a way to kind of relieve stress and to relax in a day, reward ourselves, only to then find ourselves like stressed that we can't read them all, we can't scroll enough, or we can't get caught up in everything. Sports are played morally when we delight in them for their own sake, but also as directed toward the higher good of a life of prayer and work. This means that we must moderate our love of sports. On the side of deficiency, there is the workaholic who can never play because his mind is consumed by the demand for productivity and money-making. On the side of excess, there is the fanatic, who in his desire to play all the time fails to offer up time and talent to his maker, his family, his community. Neither the workaholic nor the fanatic can be friends in the full sense of the term, for they are consumed by lower goods and so have no room in their lives to desire the good for others. When we play sports rooted in friendships ordered toward truth, we may open ourselves up to the deeper meaning of the saying, let the best one win. We want the best one to win because we want justice. And our love for justice in sports is caused by our love for the good itself, for the good that we come to know when we become excellent, or when we witness and admire excellence in our competitors. When the best win and we say yes to this, we see how our competition is a cause of unity rather than division. While not all who come to know this make the further step of giving thanks to the God who instills in us love for him and our neighbor, their striving on is driven by what Scripture calls the desire of the everlasting hills. With this in mind, let me conclude. Just a little practical advice. As we age, we become less and less capable of physical exertion. We cannot throw as hard as we once could. We are more likely to pull a muscle, and we need more rest in between games. If we keep the contemplative purpose of life in mind, we see that it is not so much the playing of the game, but the strategizing and thinking about it that's truly enjoyable. It may be hard to convince you of this, but the coach enjoys the game more than the players do, because he knows it better than they do, and as a result is more directly the cause of the victory than they are. And I think players often know that. The fans don't always, but the players generally know that. As Aquinas puts it when reflecting on Aristotle's saying that it belongs to the wise to order things rightly, among all human pursuits, the pursuit of wisdom is more perfect, noble, useful, and full of joy. The game gets better as you age, when you bear in mind this point. Otherwise, you'll fall into the trap of destroying and perhaps even hating your body due to your disordered attachment to the play of youth. We must each of us know when it is time to hang up the spikes and cultivate the kind of character that allows us to look at those spikes later in life with gratitude for the gift of play. This is especially true when we discover in ourselves the calling to married, priestly, or religious life. Here, we may even have to give up the prospect of going pro with our game, given, in the case of marriage, the possibility that we may not be able to make a living off of it, or in the case of priestly or religious life, due to the incompatibility between our vocation and professional sports. A second piece of practical advice is to cultivate this love of wisdom in sports by attending to the overflowing of goodness that gives us the runner's high, the experience of being better than ourselves, of being touched by grace. What happens to us in such moments and in the streaks that we have? Why is it that no matter how hard we practice, there's still something about sports excellence that is outside of our control? We suddenly get in the zone, then we're out of it. And it may be more often the more we practice, but it's not up to us. It's this thing, goodness, that's in us. There's a gift there. If you pay attention to this in yourself and ponder these deeper reasons why we love sports, you'll find yourself welcoming the transition from player to coach or participant to spectator. You'll find yourself not envying the greatness of your friend or of a rising star, but being thankful that by admiring them and even seeing them as what Aristotle calls another self, you are free to take part in the delights of contemplation. While this in itself will not necessarily make you a saint, it will help you understand what St. Paul means when he tells us, I have fought the good fight, I have finished the race, I have kept the faith. From now on, there is reserved for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give me on that day, and not only to me, but also to all who have longed for his appearing. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.